Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, listening audience. This is King, and welcome to the Conscious Capitalist. It's a great Tuesday. I hope everyone out there is listening and everyone is having a great time. I'm really excited today to introduce you to our guest that we have on our show. And she is a person that I have seen her work on TV, and I'm very excited to have on the show. Her name is Wendy Grantham. She was born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, but grew up in Wilmington, Delaware. She graduated from Harvard University, then moved to New York City to attend a new actors workshop, a two-year full-time program run by George Mason, Paul Scalise, and film director Michael Nichols. She worked on stage, but most notably in writer Charles Gordon's revival of his Pulitzer Prize-winning play, No Place to Be Somebody, which started as a national tour bound for Broadway. It closed halfway through the tour because of contractual difficulties. She did off-Broadway work and was a stand-in for A Different World in Los Angeles before guest starring on Homicide, Life on the Street, appearing in the film Killing Emmett Young and assuming her most notable role to date, that of Chardine Ennis, the sweet-natured stripper turned police informant and then detective's wife on HBO's The Wire. She's also a singer and worked for many years in Philadelphia with Johnny O and the Classic Dogs of Love, the Sid Miller Orchestra, and with Catch Productions. She currently has her own band, Julep, which she plays the music she loves, jazz, blues, and old soul, with some American thrown in for good measure. And she resides in the Philadelphia area. So without any further ado, I'd like to welcome to our show, the Conscious Capitalist, Mrs. Wendy Grantham. My apologies.
No problem. Hi.
Am I pronouncing your last name correctly, Grantham?
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I just want to make sure.
Definitely.
Welcome to the show, Wendy. How are you doing today?
Thank you. It's nice to be here, and I'm doing well. I'm well today. It's a beautiful day. It's nice and sunny, so no complaints.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Actually, we can tell we're on the same coast because here in Baltimore, it's a beautiful day here as well. So why don't we get right into it? Now, one of the ways we'd like to start our show is to really set the context by allowing our listening audience the chance to kind of know you and kind of we'd like to define as your story or your purpose in life. And why don't you share that with our listening audience?
Let's see. I would say my purpose is probably just to use whatever abilities or talents I have to help people. I think at the end of the day, that's kind of the most important thing I can do, you know, is to provide care where there maybe isn't any. And people are, I think that's probably it.
No, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. You said people are, you'll be getting a thought.
Oh, no, I was just going to say part of why I went into the career I did, I went into the arts, or I saw an art as a kind of celebration of people, but also just a kind of way to understand them better. I have always had a kind of reverence for them and also a kind of fear of them. But I think that, you know, if we can't help each other, what's the point, you know? So
absolutely. Well, you definitely have the conscious capitalist mindset there in that context. I believe that we are born to serve, and the manner in which we serve depends on the purpose that we have, that we go through our, the purpose we have in our lives, that we go through self-discovery to discover. But I do believe we're definitely here to serve others.
Yes.
Now, who would you say has been the greatest influence in your life?
My mother. My mother is, she's just a force. She was a teacher, and then she went on to be an administrator, and then she went on from there to be a superintendent. But she specializes in turnaround schools and in districts that are struggling. But she's just a people person, and she's just always been one of those people who, you know, she and my grandmother was very much that way. My grandmother grew up in Arkansas and ended up in Pittsburgh. But the whole idea of, you know, well, people need, you know, my grandmother was always volunteering somewhere or, you know, helping with this and helping with that. And my mother has been very much that way with, you know, the kids that she's taught and the places that she's been trying to just, she's, when I talked about care, it's like she's someone who knows how to provide care on a multitude of levels. And I think that's something that, it's a skill people have to learn. You know, you can be willing to do it, but people don't always know how to best apply to how best to help. And she's very good at kind of assessing what people need and how to get right at it. So probably her.
Is your mom originally from the South?
No, my mom was born in Pittsburgh.
Okay, she's born in Pittsburgh. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You know, what's interesting, you talk about your mom and your grandmother, so it's been generational, so you intend to kind of carry that, pick up the baton and continue that strong Black woman servant role, I assume, correct?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's kind of what's expected, I imagine, you know, in a way, but not in a bad way, not like, oh, you know, it's not like, oh, this is your burden in life. I don't mean it that way. I just mean, like, you know, there's been a blueprint established that kind of works. So there's no fear of implementing it, you know. There's no fear or attached to, oh, you know, is this going to cost me too much or is this going to... No, it doesn't. My dad is inspirational in a different way, but my father had a very different upbringing and... you know, he's kind of more achievement oriented, which has its place, but and he does help people too, just in a very different way.
Okay.
My mom's the kind, you know, you can come put your head on her shoulder. My father's the kind that says, you know, okay, he's very rational. He was a businessman. He used to run the NBA Players Union. So he spent a lot of time helping young basketball players for many, many years to get what they needed. So he's of the same mindset. It's just done in a different capacity. It was always as related to business.
Sounds like I need your father here in Baltimore City when we're doing our work. Kind of one of the things we want to do is, as a business entrepreneur, I want to allocate a certain amount of my funds to reaching back and helping some of the young athletes in the area and put them on the right on the right path and put them in the right environment that's nurturing and they can help make sure that they stay focused on their schoolwork and get them off the streets. But I don't really have the experience in running any kind of NBA program, so that's something that I've been looking to make those kind of connections with gentlemen who have that passion and have that kind of commitment.
Definitely.
Now, what would you say are your core values that help keep you centered in life?
Critical thinking, integrity, decency. And, you know, I make an effort to be kind. And to not, I'm not big on judgment. You know, I try pretty much to take people where they are, and, you know, it's not my, you know, I don't spend a lot of time saying somebody should have done this or should have done that. It's none of my business. You know, I just feel like wherever they are, then that's, you know, I take people where they are.
You know, I listen to that. Each time I ask someone a question, immediately I begin to think about what core values that we actually have in common based on your answers. And of course, you mentioned integrity, and that's definitely one that I share. I think integrity is very important for me, being a person of integrity. You mentioned being kind. I think that's important. There's a gentleman I used to work with, and his favorite, or I would say his motto was, "I'm kind, but I'm not nice." You know, he was saying
right, okay.
People were trying to take advantage of him, but he was a kind person that believed in helping others, you know. But I think that's a very important question as it relates to trying to get an understanding of who you're going to connect with nowadays. And I think that's what's kind of missing from this social media world of making connections on social media. People can write that. That these are their values, but you know, you can kind of assess that when you get a chance to actually meet someone in person and talk to them in dialogue. And within, you know, I'll say within the first 3 minutes of a conversation, the person says, I'm an honest person, I'm of integrity, then you can really see, are you truly of integrity or is it just something you're actually saying because it's
exactly. No, I understand that completely. It's very true. A lot of people say it, but you kind of have to wait and see, you know?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Now, who in the arts area has been your greatest inspiration?
In the arts?
Yes.
Wow, I have a few. That's tough. Paul Robeson, because he could do everything and did. Toni Morrison, because she just writes amazingly. James Baldwin, because he can get right at the heart of things. I would say the same about Virginia Woolf. For literature, I would say the same about Marguerite Duras. As far as filmmakers go, I'm a big fan of Robert Altman. And Fellini. And Michelangelo Antonioni. The arts inspiration list is very long. I'm a huge fan of Nina Simone. She's probably, you know, my favorite singer. If I had to pick one, I'd probably pick her. Although I love, you know, Ella Fitzgerald and Sarah Vaughan still and Dinah Washington. I really love a lot of those voices from the 40s and the 30s. And the music particularly, I like the romanticism of the music. And I like the way... I really like the classic element to what's behind them, the full orchestra. I love that sound. So I don't know if that was clear.
No.
There's so many people.
I can understand that. Well, you know, just starting off with your very first choice, and Paul Robeson, I mean, I think he definitely does not get a lot of credit in our society historically and definitely within our race historically. As far as the contributions that he gave to our society, his, again, somewhat of integrity that we mentioned earlier, a man who understood how to leverage his stardom or his fame to advocate for things that he believed in, to be an athlete, an attorney, orator, as well as an actor, you know, where
and a singer.
And a singer, you know, and he wore all those hats extremely well. You know, old folks used to say, they don't make him like that anymore.
Right.
And, you know, he suffered for his, you know, his beliefs and his commitment to his ideology. You know, a lot of folks are not willing to do that. They're not willing to, they're willing to make a statement, but they're not willing to sacrifice possible a loss of income, of stardom, of their so-called celebrity, you know, and
definitely,
he was willing to do that, you know. So that's someone, you know, I would love to see someone make a movie about him. I've always said that. When I first read his book, I said, why don't we have a movie about Paul Robeson, you know, that we can, and get some iconic person to play him. Like, I would think maybe a Lawrence Fishburne, someone like that, maybe
right,
to play him, and, you know, because we need to have his story told on a big screen that folks can actually see.
Yeah. I mean, they've done him on Broadway. I saw Avery Brooks do a show on him on Broadway, and it was wonderful. He did a great job.
You're actually right. I saw Avery Brooks do that same performance. I don't know if it's the same performance, but I saw him in the one-man show at Howard University. And so you were absolutely right. He would be perfect for to play him on the big screen. I love Avery Brooks as an actor as well. So I mentioned in your bio that you attended Harvard University, and you know, what I'm curious about is, why did you choose Harvard to go to, and kind of how was your experience at Harvard?
Well, I chose it because I came out of, I chose it because of what I came from. I mean, I'm from Delaware, and the state of Delaware didn't really desegregate the schools until 1978, at which time I was in sixth grade. And, you know, I had trouble with teachers along the way. My eighth grade teacher stands out particularly because he was, you know, I went to get help with algebra, and he essentially said there was nothing he could do because there was no way I could understand something as complicated as algebra. And he just let me essentially fail for the year I was in his class, not quite the whole year, because I ended up switching out and going to another teacher. But in the end, what happened was, to get me away from those people, I ended up attending Westtown Friends School, which is just outside of Philadelphia, and it's a Quaker school. And it was wonderful for me in the sense that it was the first place where I had people who actually said, okay, well, if this is what you want to know, we'll teach you, you know, how can we help? As opposed to, you know, you're the black girl, so just keep your mouth shut. So I wanted to pick, I picked Harvard because I naively thought that this would be the end of it, that this would be the end of people saying, oh, you know, saying, well, you can't be smart because you're black, or you can't be smart because you're a girl. And, you know, I figured this will shut some people up and this will be the end of that. And that was very naive because, of course, it wasn't. And not only was it not, but Harvard was a very, at that time, kind of hostile environment to be in for black students. But it was a mixed bag. I mean, there were things, it was a love-hate relationship I had with it. I loved my classes. I loved a lot of my classmates. I loved being there. It was the only school I attended for 4 years. Like, when, as in, from, you know, first through 12th grade, I went to 10 schools in 12 years. So, you know, I was constantly moving around. I was at Harvard for 4 solid years. It was like home. But then the other parts of it that I didn't like as much dealt more with the fact that some of the faculty, particularly in the social sciences, were, you know, still had harbored some rather, you know, beliefs, and, you know, were in no rush to change their mind. And it was one of those things where, you know, they would go out in the field and do research, and then they kind of live off that research for the next 20 years or so. But in that 20-year period of time, social science changes very quickly, and social people, what's happening to people, to demographics, changes very quickly, particularly for black people, because we're almost always at the whim of policy. So as policy affects our lives, things change. And so what they weren't able to do really was keep up with that change. So I would have people in I'd had a professor in a classroom tell me my experience and just be wrong, because I knew and had lived the opposite of what he was saying. So there was obviously there a point of contention, and now I'm put in a position where I have to rebel. So there's that part, which was not so fun. But it taught me a lot about, you know, I mean, it's been a life of that. It's been, you know, there's the majority and then there's you. And then if you're a girl or smart and black in America, you basically, you're constantly in a state of rebellion. You don't have any choice because they constantly escort you to place and you don't fit there. So you have no choice but to fight against it because you can't occupy that space. So, and that's not just for smart people, that's just black people, period. But when you add that on top of it, when you try to move up these circles and you try to advance in areas that are predominantly white, this is the kind of opposition that you find. You're kind of in a no-win situation. You know, it's very difficult for you to be a young person and constantly be battling adults. Because you always feel like, well, what if you're wrong? You know, the questions that you're asking are different than, you know, your fellow counterparts that get to go be young and they get to go to parties and do this and that and just believe that people in authority actually know more than you do. Well, we didn't have that luxury. So that's, it puts you in a difficult place. But also, you know, there's a lot of information to be gleaned from it.
Now, there's definitely raises the question in my mind of something I constantly hear, that and the difficulty of an educated black woman, particularly, you know, you went to Harvard University and all that accolades that's associated with that. Excuse me. Have you found it difficult to find a mate who can, or a partner who can understand and not be intimidated by your education, as well as accept you for the ability and accomplishments that you have?
That's a loaded question, because there are a lot of different factors that factor in. There are a lot of different things that determine the answer besides just what you're, just what you think would be. For example, I would say no, I don't have difficulty. But I'm also preconditioned a certain way. Like, it depends on, like, for example, what do you come from? Do you come from, like, I'm a child of divorce, you know? So I have this whole idea about relationship and what it is. And to me, you know, it's kind of, I don't necessarily expect it will last forever. I think the relationship's good when it's good, and then, you know, like everything else, sometimes it has an expiration date, and that's fine with me. So when I go into something, I'm not going, oh my God, is this going to be the man that'll be with me for the rest of my life? I don't approach a relationship that way. So given that I don't, and I'm not saying I go in saying, oh, this is only going to be like temporary. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that for whatever length of time it is and it's good, that's fine. So I have different expectations than a lot of women. I don't keep prisoners, for example. I'm not hanging on to a man. Like, if I feel like my constant feeling about a relationship is that it works while it's working. If I'm in it and you're in it and we're together and we enjoy each other, that's great. But if you wake up in the morning and say, I need to be with this chick or that chick, then I feel like you have to go do that. Like, I don't want you to stay with me when you really want to be somewhere else. So I have different kind of, my expectations are just different than a lot of women's expectations. So I've not had any trouble, because, you know, my feeling is, I mean, I meet a lot of men. I've been in a relationship right now for 10 years, and it's great, and I have no complaints about it. But even before him, I don't feel like I had a problem. But I also think that I have a very, what I'm looking for is a different thing than a lot of people. I think if I were looking to get married, for example, I may have some difficulties, but I'm not.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
It makes sense. I should have framed the question better. I definitely appreciate your answer. What I was really curious about, have you found the difficulty, or should I say this way, has having a degree from a higher-end institution such as Harvard, do you find it has lessened the pool of available choices out there for you? Do you find it that difficult to find men at your level of intelligence and experience? That's why I was really writing the question that kind of.
No, I don't, because I don't correlate experience or intelligence with higher learning.
Okay.
I think there are plenty of really smart men out there who haven't gone to Harvard. I think there are plenty of really smart men out there who haven't gone to college at all. So, I mean, my boyfriend's a musician. He didn't go to college, but he's smart. I mean, I don't equate. My point is, you know, if he's an intelligent man, he's an intelligent man. It's not correlated to me with, but I also understand I'm not a business person. See, that's the other thing. I think sometimes when people are in business, then it's harder for them, because usually in order to be a successful business person, you need to be placed as far as degrees and as far as, you know, a typical corporate setting, you need a certain kind of background in order to have a corporate life. Because I'm in the arts, I don't have that. So I don't know that would be true if I were a banker or a lawyer. But as an artist, it's not true. There's no difficulty.
Okay. Now, what are some of your rituals, daily practices that you do to keep yourself positive and focused as a conscious leader?
I have to exercise or else I'm like a lunatic. no, I'm not. But I think exercise is really important. Also trying to, you know, I read somewhere that, you know, because I'm a bit of a hypochondriac and I'm a little bit neurotic, and I found that, you know, I read something that was saying, you know, if you spend your time to think dark thoughts and dwell in dark places is to essentially, you know, misuse your mind. And I thought that was kind of, you know, I mean, it's a little bit platitudinish, but at the same time for me, it was like, okay, yes, just redirect. I spent a lot of time, you know, I could be kind of freaked out by things if I allow myself to be, but I really do try to focus on what is it I'm trying to do, how do I get there, the logistics, working out the logistics of that, and keeping a good schedule, because if you're in the arts and you have days where you don't work, you know, it's very easy to kind of drift if you don't set a schedule and set out to do certain things. Like, I write for a certain number of days, I mean, for certain hours per day, and I exercise from this point to this point. But to keep a schedule to make sure that I'm moving forward is something I think is paramount.
I concur completely. Now, what attracted you to choose a career in the arts?
I didn't fit anywhere else. I had some bad experiences as a young person. I thought I'd be an architect or maybe a lawyer, and things kind of went a certain way. And then when I got to college, someone very important to me was murdered. And then there were all these deaths. During the 4 years I was at Harvard, there were like 10 deaths of friends and family. And it just pushed me so far outside the realm of regular experience that I felt like it didn't make sense to me anymore to have a regular job, because there were things I needed to get at first. Like, I had kind of always been someone who had valued the intellect over my emotional life, because I felt my emotional life was very dangerous, you know. But once those things happened, once I lost those people, it was like, okay, you have to figure out now how to relate not only to your own emotions, but to relate better to people. I was very, very shy, and I didn't know how to talk to people and was desperately afraid of people. And so, so where everybody else was thinking about, okay, we want to go get a job at the bank or I'm going to law school, I was thinking, how am I going to get over this fear? How am I going to be a better person and address this fear and be able to relate to people better, since you only have them for such a short period of time? So I left school and got a job at the supermarket, which people think is insane, but it wasn't, because of what I needed. In the supermarket for the five minutes that I had to ring these people up and get them through the line, my task was to look in their faces, say hello to them, say something nice to them or engage them in some way, and then wrap it up and say goodbye and move them on. It took me 4 months to be able to comfortably do that. That was what skill that I was missing. And most people think, well, you go to Harvard, how are you going to go work at the supermarket? Well, it depends on what skill you need. That was the skill, that addressed the skill that I needed in a way that me going on to work at a bank or going back to school would never have done. I had to leave school because I needed to get out into the world and be with people and figure out how they work and who they are and how to get along out there. And so that sent me to the arts from that point, because I figured that if acting were heightened living, then somewhere along the line I might learn like regular living. And that's not really how it worked out, but it was enough of an impetus to get me there. And so from there, what was important to me was the whole story concept and how that affects people and relationship and just people. Like, I didn't feel like I could have a career that was not in some way focused on humanity. So that's what I needed, and that's what I did.
What are some of the challenges you faced with having chosen a career in the arts? I mean, you kind of talked a little bit about it in your first answer, but I just kind of want you to expand on it, anything that really comes to mind.
What kind of challenges as an actor? Well, in the art, it's, well, okay, first of all, the biggest challenge is that art isn't art anymore. I chose to go into acting right at the point, right at that time when art became entertainment. And entertainment doesn't serve me. And entertainment isn't art, and it's very different. It has a very different purpose. Entertainment is about telling people, is about reassuring people, showing them what they want to see so that, you know, they feel good or they get some kind of gratification from it, where art is supposed to do the opposite. Art is supposed to push you past what you're comfortable doing and challenge all those notions that you think you have and that challenge the things you think you know so that you can see something broader or bigger or better. And particularly for black people, and even and some for Asians and some for other minorities, but particularly for black people, given our history in America, it never occurred to me that the film and television industry would be like 20 years behind real time. You know, like, for example, I'm a Harvard graduate. I could have gone to law school, but I can't play a lawyer on television. You know, I mean, I have to be the receptionist, or I have to be the maid, or I have to be... And I have to say, there's nothing wrong with being a black person and being a maid. Please understand that is not the point I'm making. The point that I'm making is, when you have an overrepresentation of a certain type of thing, then what that's doing is limiting the freedom of every possibility. You should be able to be anything. If you're a black person, you can be anything. But you can't be depicted as being anything on television, because that's not comfortable for the majority of audiences. Black women who are smart never been at the top of the list of things that people want to see in entertainment. So thank God for Hidden Figures. You know, I mean, this is 20 years after the fact that after I started acting. But yes, you finally have something like that for mainstream, and that's great. But look at how long it took. It took a very long time. And we still have a lot of direction, have to move a lot in that direction. There's far more work to be done. So it was tough in that way. It's tough if you're female. It's tough if you're black. The other thing is just being a girl. You know, like for my male friends, they'll write a movie and they'll just put their friends in it. And they'll say, hey, you know, we've got 15 parts for guys, but there's only one part for a girl. So you, as the only girl, you have to compete with, you know, several other female friends to get this one part. Whereas the guys, they just can all just show up on set. Like, that's kind of not fair. But, I mean, that's just what it is. That's just, you know that going in, that it's a male-dominated, that it's a male-dominated field, and that there are a lot more stories that involve men. That's just how it is. So we're used to that, but it is definitely a struggle, and it makes our careers, you know, slower. We don't get as many credits as quickly. And then there's the whole couch thing, but that's another whole issue. And I didn't have to do any. I didn't do any of that, which may be why I didn't get very far. But yes, there is the casting couch thing is kind of real.
You said the casting couch?
The casting couch story is kind of real about, you know, women sleeping with men to get certain parts. You know, that does exist. But I was never tempted to do that because what's the point? I mean, I don't know. To me, it always seemed, I don't trust, I'm not that trusting. I always figured you could do that, but then what if they just turn around and you don't get anything? You just put yourself in a terrible position for nothing. So,
yes.
Nah.
So but, let me ask you, if you could write and star in the perfect role for, that you feel that would be one that you would be your career-defining role as an actor, what role would that be? Kind
of, say that one more time. I'm sorry, I didn't hear it.
If you can write as well as, or maybe not necessarily write, but if you can just act in your career-defining role, not necessarily from a stardom perspective, but a role that would give you the most fulfillment, that you would say, this role defines, this is the role of my life. What could you talk about, what role that would be? What story would it be? And what would your character play? Who would you be as?
What was the last part?
Who would you be as a character? In other words, what would your character as a profession do? What would be some of the heartbreaks and challenges they would have to overcome? Just kind of, I know it's a broad question, but I'm just trying to get an idea of, if you had your choice to say, here's the perfect role for me, what would that look like?
It might be easier to tell you based on roles that have already existed that other people have played. Like, I don't know if I could tell you based on, I don't think I could tell you that way. I think, like, I think if you look at actresses and you look at the types of roles that they're able to get, and you can look at those and say, I want a career like that, or I would want to play roles like that. Like, I think that's probably an easier way to get at what you're asking me. And I would probably say, like, if I looked at actresses who had, where I'd say, no, that's an ideal career. Like, those kinds of roles are good roles. Then I would look at actresses like Patricia Arquette or Nicole Kidman, for example, or, you know, those are the kind, even Julia Roberts, those kinds of roles are really not available to us. With that kind of complexity, they're not available to us. So.
Let me ask you this question that's, you know, something I've been noticing myself. I just want to get your opinion and perspective on it as someone who's in the industry. I think that when, unless you are a superstar, black, I'm speaking of a black superstar in the acting world, winning an Oscar seems to be a career, it's like it destroys your career. You know, now, again, you know, someone like Denzel Washington is an exception. But you look at other folks who have won Oscars, such as Monique, Jamie Foxx, Cuba Gooding Jr., Halle Berry, they never had any significant roles after they won an Oscar. Is that something that I'm just seeing myself, or have you noticed that as well? Is that something that's commonly talked in the arts or active world?
Well, I think, honestly, that there aren't that many parts for them, period. Like, I think that doesn't change. Like, what happens is with white actresses and actors, sometimes after they win an award, all of a sudden now there are not only people who are willing to write for them, but they're going to be considered for a whole other, for a higher tier of project. And a lot of times that doesn't exist for black actors. Like, that higher tier of project was what you won the Oscar for. That's as high a tier as you're going to get. Do you know what I mean? Like, for us, I'm not saying because of their ability. I'm saying because that's just how it works, and I think that it's intentional. Like, I think that that there's a certain level, there's a certain type of role that's more prevalent than others. For example, for black women, you know, if you're willing to play the ultimate victim, I mean, there's something to me about victimhood, victimizing black women and then giving them awards for it, I find disturbing. Now, don't confuse that with the acting. Halle Berry was fantastic. Lupita Nyong'o was fantastic. But the idea that white audience will reward you for being depicted at your lowest is something that I find disturbing. Like, if Lupita had played a secretary, I'm not sure that they would have rolled out that red carpet like that. Like, you know what I mean? It's like, okay, well, she's been a slave and she's abused, and this is the worst possible circumstance that you could ever be in, and she has depicted it. So now we'll roll out the carpet because she's already shown us, you know, that we've won. That sounds horrible, but in a way, that's what's happening. I mean, it's kind of really scary. They didn't give it to Angela Bassett for playing Tina Turner, who came back and won, you know, and was triumphant. They gave it to two roles for which black women were depicted as not being able to defend themselves and not being in having great inner strength, but not having their own agency. And I think that is something that we constantly find ourselves in. That we're constantly cast as women without agency, as prostitutes, as crack mothers, as whatever. Whatever the situation is, we are at the whim of other people to help us. That's how we're depicted. And that's how we win awards.
You know, we spent quite a bit of time. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, but I want that to remain. I mean, I want it to be clear. I'm talking about the depiction. I am not talking about the actresses. The actresses are fabulous, and they've done everything they're supposed to do. It has nothing to do with that. Okay.
I definitely get your point and understand that, because I've heard other folks, and I agree with you in that context. But I know that we spent a lot of time on your acting career, and I just definitely want to give some time, because we're running short on time, to talk about your music career as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to make sure we get some time for you to talk about that. So with that being said, you were in a new band called Julep.
I have, yes.
You're in a band called Julep. Tell us about Julep. What kind of band is Julep as far as type of musicians comprise Julep, make up Julep, and what type of music does Julep play?
Well, it can be anywhere from a 5-piece to a 10-piece band, depending on if I have a horn section or not. And we play jazz and blues. It's a jazz blues band. And then also, it's kind of bifurcated. It kind of moves in two directions. We play jazz and blues, particularly for corporate events. And then we also do original music, which is kind of in the old soul direction. That's kind of what it is and what we do. But I particularly like, you know, just old-fashioned 12-bar blues. And I like jazz from anywhere from the 20s through the 40s and even up to the 60s, depending on what it is. But I particularly love the standards, so we do a lot of that.
Is there a favorite? Well, I know this would be a very difficult question to ask. But what are some of your favorite covers that, you know, if you're going to be, when your band gets together, you say to yourself, I want to make sure we cover these particular songs. Is there songs that always fit into your lineup that you have to play for your own personal preference? And if so, what would those songs be?
The Very Thought of You is one. In This World, I'm Glad There Is You is another one. I Wish You Love. Isn't It a Lovely Day? Let's see. Blue Songs. I Idolize You by Tina Turner. Rock Me Baby. What else? Sunday Kind of Love. You Don't Know What Love Is. And also The Man I Love. Those are probably my favorites.
Where did the name Julep come from?
Well, there's that drink, mint julep, and I was thinking julep is kind of, I wanted something that was a little southern but also wasn't necessarily attached to a drink. Plus, I think there is a band called Mint Julep already. So it kind of gives you, it suggests a kind of southern thing without really saying what it is.
Do you write music as well?
I do. Well, I don't write, I write songs. I don't really write. I have a collaborator who writes the music. So I write the music. I write the lyrics and melodies. Someone else writes the music.
And can you name a few of your songs that you've written?
I could, but nobody's heard them yet. we're just in a position right now. We're about to do a live showcase. Coming up in June, but it's the first we've moved forward with this, with the original part. So they've not been released. No one could find them.
Well, I just meant from a title. I just want to kind of get a.
Oh, from a title? Okay,
title.
One's called The Hard Way. There's one called Don't You Have a Little Time? There's one called Hollywood. There's one called Four Little Hands. I'm not sure the titles really tell you anything though, because I tend to want them to have a twist. Like the title generally is something you wouldn't have picked. It's something you might not have. It's just like an overall thing you should have in mind while you listen to the song. The songs are usually about something else. They're not really related to the titles, but.
It's the reason I asked you that is I know that, you know, take someone like Sade, and I love Sade's music. You know,
me too.
One of the few artists I can actually work, listen to her music and work to her music because I don't let the lyrics take me away from what I'm doing. But if you really listen to her songs, they're all sad and melancholy. You know, there's. You know, so that's why I was asking you to get an understanding of the title of your songs. Are your songs kind of all follow one kind of mood, or are you a variety of different moods that you write about? So that's why I was getting going with that particular question.
I try to get in a variety of type of moods. Like some of them, a lot of them are about various kinds of losses, but at the same time, I don't think they're maudlin. Like some of them are about, you know, rebirth, or it is more mood, and I've found that sometimes what I can't do with the lyrics or melody, I make sure is done in the music. Like if you really want to get a mood across, and it's a mood that's not particularly disturbing, then obviously, you know, you have to be careful about the music that and the instrumentation that you choose. So yeah, I would say ultimately, it's not designed to be disturbing. Although it's not necessarily designed to be something that you just put on in the background either. It depends.
Yeah.
It's different than. I understand what you mean. Sade has a particular sound, and her music is different than this. But I really like her, what she's doing.
Now, do you enjoy singing or acting more? Which one would you say gives you more fulfillment and more expresses who you are better?
I think they both do. I just think that singing's harder for me right now because I haven't been doing it as long, and because it's different. It's very different. There's no like fourth wall, so. You have to actually kind of deal with the audience, and it's a very different thing. Like when you're on stage doing plays, like you don't really engage the audience so much. You know, you more like engage other actors and people watch. Singing is not like that, so it's scarier. But they do very different things. Very different things. So that's a hard question to answer. I'm not sure either one. Singing you can't hide as much, but I don't necessarily know that that makes it more honest. That's a good question. I'm not sure to think about that.
What would you say has been your greatest adversity that you've had to overcome in life?
Well, prior to this year, I would have said loss, but this year I had breast cancer. I was diagnosed with stage one, and that was really, really frightening and horrible, and I lost a year being treated for it between surgery and then chemotherapy and then radiation and then another operation, another surgery. So that is definitely, I think, taken the prize. that gets the prize, but yeah, I mean, we're on an upswing at this point, so. And, you know, now you just, you know, all my major treatment is over, so now I'm just trying to resume my normal life or something like that. So.
How did you mentally prepare yourself for the battle with cancer? I mean, How did you mentally prepare yourself for the battle with cancer? Was there certain?
There's no preparing. There's really no preparing. What I had was I had really good support from family. My mom was. I wouldn't have done it. I wouldn't have made it without her, my mom, because I'm a hypochondriac. So, of course, I always assume something's wrong, and this time something really was wrong. So I was like, oh, now what? You know, so I was in a constant state of panic. And, you know, they tell you all these things, like when you get this, take this medication or all the treatments, they tell you all the possible side effects. And it was like, just stop reading those because, you know, every single one, I'm like, oh, I have that, oh, I have that. You know, it's like, no, just leave it alone. So I had to learn to redirect and to really not think so comprehensively and try to see the big picture, to just deal with the pieces that are in front of me and move slowly and methodically and not freak myself out. And that was hard, but I'm still working on it. But there were some good things about it. Like I learned, nothing is all horrible, and I learned some very important lessons about my own personal boundaries and about, you know, that I need to have a different relationship with my body than the one I had had. Like, I'd had a lot of trauma and a lot of fear, and I had to learn how to deal with that. Like, this is more traumatic than anything I had prior to it, but you still have to learn how to address that so that it doesn't just take over your life. So that's where I am right now, learning that, and I would not have had to even deal with that without this. So,
is there one thing or several things that you would say you learned about yourself as a result of going through what you're going through with cancer?
Yeah, I would say it was always a little bit ambiguous for me as someone who was very cerebral. Like, I kind of lived in my head and really didn't deal with my body. Like, it was kind of like a scary place to be because, like, as a child I'd had infant migraines, and it's like I would just be playing or doing something, and as an infant and all through my childhood. And then all of a sudden, you know, I'd just be laid up with this horrible headache, and it was like your body could just attack you was kind of the lesson I took from it. And I was like kind of just steered clear of it and kind of just stayed in my head and didn't want to deal with anything that had to do with the physical. And I put off, it was like I wanted to have a baby, but I was terrified of it because I had two young friends die in childbirth. I was like, oh God, it's too dangerous, I don't want to do it. You know, I learned that my body could do a lot of things, that it could go through a lot of things, and I have a different relationship with it now than I did before then. And also I know, I think I have a better sense of that personal boundary, my space, my body versus where the rest of the world, you know, there was a lot of blurring for me between, you know, like how much am I responsible for in the rest of the world, and like, you know, how much I had no real clear sense of how much I should worry about other people's problems and blah, 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 you know. It was like, this made it really clear. Okay, these are your problems. This is your body. This is the rest of the world. You know, this is the boundary that exists. It made it much clearer in the way it's never been clear in my almost 50 years of, you know, I'm 49, so it's never been this clear before. And it kind of alleviated in some ways a lot of stress because it clarified some things for me, so that did help. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
Okay.
Is there any advice that you want to give women out there who, for helping to early detection or treatment or, you know, anything that you might want to share with us and audience in that regard?
Get your mammograms. They found this on a routine mammogram, so make sure you go. And also, there are no oncology guidelines, unfortunately, it appears. Like, every oncology is different everywhere. So see a few doctors, get a few opinions about treatment, and have a circle of people that you trust. I got very lucky because I had a family. My sister's a pathologist, and we also had a family friend who's an oncologist. So not only did I get their help, but also, you know, I went to see doctors and visit. So I got a lot of information, and I would say stress that people should do that because it's really scary. It's a hard decision to make how to be treated, and you need to be able to trust whoever you choose if you find that you have it.
We're running up on the end of the hour, and I want to give you an opportunity to talk about your show, where folks can get some information about your websites or anything else you might want to announce to our listening audience at this time.
My show?
Oh, I'm sorry, do you have any scheduled shows that you're going to be performing, that Juliet will be performing in, or concerts, or anything else you might want to announce, upcoming events, or anything of that nature?
Not just yet. I mean, I do local stuff here in Wilmington. I'll be at a place called the Gaylor Vineyards next Sunday, and also at a place in Wilmington called Ubon Restaurant. That's the 23rd. But other than that, we're lying pretty low because I took the year off. Most of these bookings get done a year in advance. So while I was doing all that stuff last year, you know, I wasn't booking myself. So I'm just getting started again with all of that. So I don't have a lot of bookings just yet.
Okay. Any website, social media information you'd like to share? How listen to audiences stay kind of in contact with you or keep abreast of when you do release your album or anything you might want to share?
I may have to just come back to you with that information when I have it.
Okay.
All of that it's all in process. I don't have a website up yet, only because I'm waiting on live recording. I mean, I'm waiting on the recordings and blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, it's not yet. But.
Okay.
Soon.
We're running down to 90 seconds, and I'll be completely remiss if I didn't ask you this question. And it's a wire-related question.
Okay.
My question is, from your character that you play, Charlene,
mm-hmm.
Ennis, who would you say that she actually enjoyed her time with more, Avon's nephew or the detective wife, as far as the where she was herself mentally?
Oh, I would definitely say being Fremont's wife. She needed stability, and he's very stable. And I think that was paramount, you know. I think, and then he's kind, you know what I mean? He's kind and he's stable, and I think that was definitely better than, you know, the whimsical thing for her with D'Angelo. Definitely.
Well, I definitely had to ask you that question, you know, because I was curious about it. Like I said, The Wire is definitely one of my favorite shows. And as we are here in Baltimore City, definitely had to get a Wire question in there. Unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to go through all the questions I had for you because you have such a very interesting life. And I love the answers
thank you.
Today. They were definitely candid. And I appreciate you taking the time out to come on the show. We definitely want to have you back on the show later on when you start the tour. But again, thank you for your time. And thank everyone for
thank
listening.
Thank you.
This has been the Conscious Capitalist. Have a great
day. Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. Have a great day. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.